to Resounds, arts and culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Poet and novelist Joe Wilkins grew up on a sheep and hay ranch north of the Bull Mountains. He currently lives in Oregon and is the director of the creative writing program at Linfield College and is the author of three poetry collections.
Wilkins' work has appeared in many literary journals, and he's the author of the memoir The Mountain and the Fathers, Growing Up in the Big Dry. His debut novel, Fall Back Down When I Die, is set in the same Bull Mountains of Montana in the early 2000s. The novel explores struggles of the West and the rural way of life. It's a beautiful, poetic, fully textured, full of language, full of characters, true to life adventure. And we're welcoming Joe to talk about it.
Joe, so glad to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah, what a beautiful novel. I have to say that I completely devoured it. And Corby, I know you've been out for a few weeks, but I wanted to show you how much I loved this novel.
That your dog chewed it.
Disclosure to our listeners, Corby lends me a lot of great books, and I got some reading material while he was out of town, and I owe you a new novel by Joe. So anyway.
You know, there is something appropriate about having that novel chewed upon. I mean, the book is about wolves and wolf hunting. Yeah, and
yeah. It's meaty. It's textured. I mean, who knew my dog was such a fan of yours? But I definitely am. So.
Oh, good, good. And I think it's, I hope, a very physical story. And so that's also
it
fitting there.
It is.
Agreed. Yes.
Your poetry, essays, short stories, mm-hmm. and now this new novel are really based in an area that you grew up in, mm-hmm. the Big Dry, mm-hmm. as we know, sort of between Reigate and Roundup and the hills there. Tell us something about your childhood and the factors that made you Joe Wilkins.
Yeah. So I grew up outside of the town of Millstone, Montana, where the Musselshell bends north to go meet the Missouri. The land that sort of opens up to the east there, where my grandfather's ranch was known as the Big Dry. And just south of us were the Bull Mountains, kind of a Badlands range of mountains. Not quite as lovely as the Rockies, but tangled and lovely in their own way. And so I grew up there on the sheep ranch. My mother's parents had originally settled in that area. And she came back with my dad, who had come to Montana from North Carolina to study forestry at University of Montana. And they traveled around a bit and eventually landed back there. And I think, you know, the real sort of fact of my life in some ways is the fact that my father died when I was 9. And so I was way out there on the frontier, as I said before, a place that's all men and territory. And I didn't have a father in my life. And so a lot of my young life was sort of searching for that. And I searched many places and found many wonderful surrogate fathers. But one of the places I looked to was books. I was long a great reader. My mother was a reader. My grandparents were readers. And so books have always been important to me. And by the time I got to college, even though I was studying other things, they just became more important. And when I finally did stumble my way into a creative writing class and realized that you could read them, but you could make them as well. It was quite a revelation and something that has been part of my life ever since.
You certainly take the voice of where you live into all the writing that you have done. I first knew you as an essayist, mm-hmm. and then your poetry book, mm-hmm. short story collection, and now a novel. But they all have, I'm trying to describe what that ring of truth is, or maybe it's something about central Montana, minimal amount of words, and actions speak for themselves.
Yeah.
Kind of sentimentality, but not romanticized.
Oh, good. I hope not. You know, I do love the place I grew up, but it's also a complicated place. And I am trying to be there and see it as plainly and clearly as I can, both the beauty of it and also the violence of it and the struggle of it. And I want to get all of that onto the page. And I want to do it in a language that honors the people in place, that doesn't take away from their stories, but adds to and deepens their stories.
Yeah, the characters are so true to life. I think what you were referencing, Corby, it seems at times they're lifted from a work of nonfiction and directly from your childhood, too. You know, you talk about Rowdy, and I recall in the novel when he gets presented this book and he's just obsessed with it.
Yeah.
And you, hearing you talk about what books meant to you as a child, that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the great joys of fiction is you get to know these characters, these new people. And of course, though, they all come from you. So there's little bits of your experience or little bits of things you've seen and known sprinkled into them. So they feel so close, you know, they feel like family.
People don't talk much in your books. There's not a lot of, I wanted that relationship to develop between the school teacher. I wanted the little boy to talk more. Yeah. I wanted the son to have a realization about his life. Is that true, do you think, of rural Montanans?
Yes, I think it's rural spaces in general. I think it's also kind of a stereotypically masculine trait not to speak, right, to hold your words close. In a lot of ways, I think one of the primary themes of the novel is speaking and listening, and when we might have the chance to do that, and when we don't take that chance, and when we do, and then when we're actually heard, fully listened to. Many of the characters here, from Verl to Wendell to Gillian, are trying to say something to people, trying to say something to a son or a daughter, trying to say something to a friend, and often they're not being heard. Or they're not saying what's most important to them, and they're trying slowly through the novel to find a way to speak to one another and then to listen to one another.
And the land is so loud.
Yeah.
And there's so much that the land has to say, and I'm curious about your background because it feels a bit southern too. I know that you spent some time in Mississippi, and there's some parallels between like rural Montana and the rural South, and I wonder how these places make it into your work.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think the land is loud. It was the great fact of my growing up life in some ways was this landscape, right? Speaking of the South, I often think that Southern fiction is so concerned with its long and convoluted history. And we have our own long and convoluted history here, but it is a little bit thinner. It's not quite as thick. What we have here is landscape. What we have here is this great, immense swath of country to deal with. And so I do think that there's commonalities between Southern writing and Western writing. The other thing I think that's key between Southern and Western writers is they're regional in the best way. I think all writing should be regional, but they treat their place with such care and mystery and sacredness, and they love it enough to tell the truth about it.
Well, the Bull Mountains terrified me.
Yeah, there's a lot of mystery out there.
I felt like, wait a minute, that's like right close to where I live, and they're frightening. Yeah. They are a character in themselves.
Okay. Good,
in terms of how they influence the people, what happens there.
Sure.
There's a certain frightening and yet sacred element to those mountains.
Yeah. There's a way in which, you know, what happens to Verl is one vision of the Bull Mountains, and then the moment that Wendell has with Rowdy is another vision.
And then there's also this inspiration that came from the armed takeover of a national wildlife refuge in Oregon in 2016. Mm-hmm. So this anti-government militia inspired you. And that is a big piece of the novel, which also draws to its frightening and mysterious characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the other reasons I've turned towards fiction is I want to listen. We, in our current political moment in this country, I think, have a dearth of listening. And some of the characters in the book I'm uncomfortable with. I don't agree with them at all. But I want to try to listen to them as much as I can, as much as I'm able. And some of those characters are inspired by the Bundys. I remember seeing Ammon Bundy on television. And every time I saw him, I thought, I know this guy. I mean, I don't really know him, but he just reminded me so much of young men I knew growing up. And I was especially troubled by sort of the way the Bundys were treated in sort of the wider news media and especially sort of among liberal outlets. They were often caricatured, made sort of treated as cartoons, and they're many things, but they're not that at all. And so I wanted here to bring these characters who I disagree with vehemently, but I wanted to bring them humanly to the page.
A humanness to them.
Yeah.
Were you living in Montana during the takeover in Jordan and the anti-government movement there?
Yes, I remember that pretty vividly. I was in high school at the time, and we'd be running track against some kids from Jordan, and they'd be talking about it, and we'd be talking about it. And it was something I talked with my grandparents with, who were very conservative in their own life. But they were trying to see their way through. And I think, you know, in a lot of ways, they might have felt some common cause with the Freemen, but they also absolutely disagreed with what they did. And I remember trying to talk through some of it with my grandfather and not really knowing what I was talking about, but wanting to know.
Yeah, and giving those characters voice throughout this novel to hear those sides of the story and really humanize them. Mm-hmm. And I love how you've broken the book out into not necessarily chapters, but characters.
Yeah.
And Verl, throughout the story, becomes more and more a poet. And I was really drawn to how not only he's disintegrating mentally, but that he becomes a more distilled and focused part of himself.
Yeah.
And if I may, I just wanted to share this section so that our listeners get a sense of how poetic it is. These segments just kind of pop in throughout the book. I wake in the dark and it is god-awful cold. I would get up and walk to warm myself but need sleep. I do not want to make mistakes. I say the sky is a bowl, but that puts the bottom at the top. What is it like, the sky? The sickle moon of a wolf's tooth. The cold star is not salt nor sugar, but torn holes, wolf-torn holes. Just that little segment, and you get this sense of somebody that is just in so much pain, and there's so much life that is going on in that person's mind at that time.
Absolutely. And again, we see him, you know, at this point, he's writing to his son. That's at least his vision for what he's doing. He's trying to explain himself, and in some ways, he explains himself, hopefully by the end, better than he thought he might. You know, he finds his way to a kind of grace, a kind of new way of seeing this place he is, right? Mm-hmm. And that's part of what that passage is about, too, is trying to re-see it. What is it like? What is it I'm seeing here?
Without giving away the storyline, he's writing, but we don't really know who he's writing to.
Right.
And we don't know his back history. Yeah. We just get these beautiful blurbs of his thoughts that are both a little crazy and yet so poetic. I kept thinking, wait a minute, this is why Joe was a poet.
There's
he
so
can write
much
this kind
texture.
Of stuff.
Yeah, the language is so gorgeous. Oh, okay. Just how you can describe a saltine shattering in someone's mouth. I mean, there's so much heavy lifting that this poetic language does in this book. And I'm curious, like, did you want to shift out of poetry to novel writing? Mm-hmm. I mean, what took you into fiction?
Yeah, great question. You know, I started as a poet, and I still write a lot of poems. They're shorter, so when you have less time, it's nice to be able to turn to those. And I think for me, poetry is essentially about language. It's about the ways we push on language and try to make it make more sense, right? Make it mean more to us than it did a moment ago. And I think that that power, we can use that in other forms too, but then there's other things that sort of step in and you have to balance with that language, right? In nonfiction, it's the sense of what you're making of your experience, how you're making sense of it. So the language is one part of that, but then that thought process, we go to nonfiction often to be with someone's mind, to hear them think through this and learn from them. In fiction, we're going to be with them physically, right? We want to follow their story. We want to be a part of it as we move forward. And so you have to balance that sense of that forward movement and that sense of being with these characters with the language. It doesn't want to get, you can't have it get in the way. But I do think too that if you're careful with it, the language can only add to that experience. It'll bring you that much closer to them, allow you to spend that much more intimate time with them.
I thought it was interesting that the little boy, this poor scarred little boy, is without language. As much as they're trying to get him to speak, it was a nice balance between this youth who has been through so much trauma and is almost afraid to talk, and here's this older man in the wilderness hiding away with this gorgeous verbal ability.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, Rowdy's inability to speak in some ways, he's sort of the scar of the book, right? He's this traumatized young child. He's the result of all these forces, economic, ecological, political, that are sort of bearing down. And he has no way to make sense of them. He doesn't even have language at this point. But slowly, you know, he does, when he comes to live with Wendell, it's in some ways what saves Wendell. And hopefully, it seems, might help save him too, as the book closes.
Now, Billings makes quite a few appearances in the novel. The locations throughout the city, like I love the vision of running up like Zimmerman Trail. Yeah. I could just picture that. The refinery scenes, the steakhouse, the coffee shop, really contrasting with that rural life in the Bull Mountains, obviously lifted directly from your own experiences.
We came into Billings for groceries. It was 90 miles away, but it was really the closest place to get groceries and get tractor parts and go to the sale yards, you know. So Billings was every 2 weeks or so, I think we would come in on a Saturday or a Sunday. And it felt to me like the biggest city in the world. It seemed so foreign. It seemed so far away from what I knew day to day. As I grew older, of course, it became more familiar and more part of my experience. But as a child, it seemed so different. And I wanted to capture that to a certain extent. And I think that's not an uncommon thing. I live in a city of 35,000 now, but it's the center of the Oregon wine industry. So it's quite a nice little town with a little fancy restaurants because people need fancy food with their nice wine. But if you travel just 5 or 10 miles out of town, you're in rural Oregon very much, and you're in a different world. And I wanted that sense, that passage between these worlds that I think sometimes we look over or we gloss over in our current culture.
One of the things that surprised me, or I guess still surprises me, is the prevalence of drugs in the last 10 or 20 years. Yeah. And people that live in Montana know that it's not an urban problem only. Right. It is very prevalent. I know I have friends that live in Harlow and Roundup, and meth has just really entered into a world that it was the last place you would ever think that would happen.
Right, right.
What are your thoughts on that?
I think that a lot of it is poverty. A lot of it is a kind of desperation. And when people are stuck, when people are struggling, they often turn where they can for a kind of relief. And in some ways, those things can be a kind of relief, at least temporarily. They're not a long-term relief. They bring more suffering in the end. But for a moment, they bring that. And I think you're absolutely right that in a lot of ways, the poverty of rural areas is different, but shares much with the poverty of urban areas. And I think that's something we don't think of. Our mythologies don't let us see that right away, but it's quite true.
I appreciated how you weren't very heavy-handed either with the drug abuse and the mom that was incarcerated. But, you know, you really told a story of poverty, of these sort of discarded foster children and what happens to them in those levels of trauma that we don't know, we don't really understand. But these are people behind these bars dealing with that.
There's also the image of the fence. And when you're in a rural environment and people are telling you when you can and when you cannot hunt, and there's nobody around for hundreds of miles, there's a lot of sentiment. It's like, hey, nobody knows. I can do what I want. This is where I live. Mm-hmm. And I felt that tension throughout the characters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What boundaries do we cross? What ones do we not cross? And when do we cross them if someone's looking or not looking? A lot of these characters are trying to find that in their own lives. Which of these fences or which of these boundaries must stand up, you know, at all costs, and which can be torn on, you know, brought down. And I think, too, you know, I spent so much of my summers as a young man fixing fence.
And wasn't
endless,
that a lot of fun?
Those afternoons fixing fence. But there is, and inherent in the fence, you know, is a whole Western history. You know, there was the idea of the open range versus the fenced range. So even in its inception here in the West, there's conflict built into it. Whose land is whose? What rights do we have to it? And now, of course, when we're talking about public lands, too, and which are used in different ways by different people, there's a lot of conflict built into your ordinary barbed wire fence out there on the range.
Well, and fencing really could indicate the end of the romanticized West that we hear about, you know, in these cowboy novels and that were sort of made famous by some of our painters around here. But the moment you put up a fence, you put up a barrier and you stop that open range, you stop that way of life. And so, you know, there is a romanticized version of the West that is, you know, kind of broken down in this novel and looked at very truthfully with this anti-government sentiment that exists.
And add a wolf to the equation about who you or what you can and cannot shoot and when it's legal or illegal.
Right.
Yeah, this is a grab bag of a lot of controversial topics. You really wanted to go for it.
I wanted to try to understand them more fully myself. These were, again, growing up here, wolf-free introduction happens in the late 80s and early 90s and was on everyone's mind in the community I grew up in. And it remains on our minds as Montanans and how we how we can learn to live in this place with the other beings of this place. And can we learn to do it, right? Can we learn to do it in a sustainable, long-term way versus a perhaps a more selfish and short-term way?
Yeah, and I love that theme carried throughout, you know, with Virl and this conversation that he's having with himself and writing down these notes to his son. Yeah. I wonder if you would mind sharing a little bit from the novel for
us. Sure. I'll read from early on when Rowdy has first come to live with Wendell, and he doesn't have a babysitter one day, and he just has to take Rowdy to work with him. And he's driving the grain truck, and I thought I'd read a little bit from there. Late in the evening, the sun bleeding through the pines, the broken land about going shattered and blue, Wendell turned to find the boy sitting ramrod straight on the bench seat, like he'd been most of the day, scrawny shoulders cockeyed, eyes wide as skipping rocks. Wendell figured Glenn would most likely work them until midnight to try to catch up, and remembering the tall bedtime tales his old man used to spin for him, he thought he might tell a story to help the boy relax, maybe even curl up and close his eyes. What say I tell a story? What would you say to that? The boy turned and blinked, waited. All right then, let me get a dip here first. Wendell reached for the can of Copenhagen he left on the dash, thumped it once and set it on his thigh. Left hand on the wheel, he carefully worked the lid off with his right and set it too on his thigh, and pinched up a chew. Just as he got the tobacco situated in his lip, the boy reached over for the tin and the lid and clicked the two together and handed the can back to Wendell. Wendell smiled, winked at the boy. I don't care what anyone says, Rowdy Burns. You're a gentleman.
I just know reading the book, I thought, please do not let anything happen to that little boy. I was terrified with all the violence going on. Yeah. And he is so scarred at the beginning. You just hope for his salvation.
I think in some ways, you know, we can measure a community by how we treat children, and especially the most vulnerable children. Mm-hmm. And I think, again, by the end, that this community has found a way, or at least for now, a way through. Right. They're trying to support him. So,
Joe, could you give us another section of Virl and hear his voice?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm going to read a section from Virl, who's out in the Bull Mountains on the run, and he's got this notebook. And the conceit here is that he's writing to his son. And so they're in the first person, and he's been sort of titling these little sections as you would a diary, perhaps. And what I've loved about Virl writing him and coming back to him is how the writing pushes on him and makes him rethink things that he's often held to be true. And I think you'll see a little bit of that in these short sections I'm going to read. Virl, day 12. They are not even close. I shook them days ago and circled back. You want to know the God honest truth, I am not so far from you, boy. It makes me smile to think on that. I have taken to sleeping in the afternoons when the sun is round and warm, writing these words in the evening. Traveling through the night and early morning when it is cold and my heart thumps and thumps to keep me warm, this afternoon I snoozed like a big old bear, only rolling over to get the sun on the other side of me. Are there bears here in the bulls anymore? I do not think so. Those like my old granddaddy killed the wolves and tried for the bears, though the bears got away up into the Rockies. I believe I am the only old bear up in these mountains now. The eastern sky this evening blue and dark as your mother's eyes. On one side of me there is that nightward blue, on the other, the far mountains red and gold in the setting sun. Did you know there's a whole box of colors between red and gold? I never knew. Or maybe I knew but forgot. Anyways, I see now some dozen shades between the two. Later. I am thinking of things. Here in the night. It was seeing the sun set like that over the Rockies, which I know are real mountains and not just twisted hills like these bulls. But these here are where I am. These I call mine. How does a body come into country? Sure, these bulls are mine because there is no other way things are, but only this way. What I'm after is what I have chosen this country. I am thinking if I was a homesteader on a train, or even earlier some fur trapper like in the Louis L'Amours. If I come strolling through, would I say, yes, this is for me? This is what I am wondering. Things are a sight prettier once you get farther west, nearer the Rockies. And it is dry hereabouts. Windy and hot in the summer, windy and cold in the winter. West of here the mountains snag the rain, and they put up three cuttings of hay without a drop of irrigation. Might I have spat and gone on? Might I have just passed through? What I am saying is maybe I have gone and gotten used to this country. No. I tried it for a spell, but that kind of thinking does not sit right with me. I do not like to think like that. Do not like to think this country I call mine is just a crapshoot chance. There is a country for each of us we might in our bones call home. The shape of the land, what fits us to ourselves. These plains and hills. That snarl of choke cherries down the draw from the house where we pick until our fingers go blue. Meadowlarks singing because they are lonesome and scared and the sun is about for the night to burn down. Do some bear up in the Rockies remember he walked these hills and plains and pine for them? I say yes. They are all a part of it, like me, like you, boy, like your granddaddy, my daddy, and our granddaddies down the line. The country is us. We know it from time before, like a hand we would miss and feel ghosting us if it was gone. Or maybe that is backwards. Maybe we are but an organ of the land. Maybe we are the ghosts, and when we go, the country mourns us. Is that right? Does the country grieve my old granddaddy, the gone grizzly bears? Does it sorrow the both of them?
Short stories, poetry, essays, novel. So, what's next?
I'm loving these long stories I can immerse myself in and go deeply into. And so I'm working on a couple of, I think, novels now. I was going great guns on one for a while and then kind of got stuck and thought, oh, I'm not sure I need to give this a little time, and then started on something else. But I'm coming back to Montana with both of them. In one, I'm trying to look more squarely at gender and the ways, especially masculinity, is portrayed in rural areas and particularly Western areas. And then in the other, I've long been fascinated by long sort of sprawling generational novels, you know, where you have the fathers and the sons and the mothers and daughters and grandmothers and grandfathers. And so I'm just starting work on a novel that sort of cascades down through the 20th century in Eastern Montana.
That's something I love about Russ Rowland's book too.
Yeah,
those multi-generations of families and secrets. Yeah. And then in terms of masculinity, certainly Sean Ray's book and his short stories
Absolutely.
Are so much about what it is to be a man in this environment.
Yeah, and how we might hold on to what is best about our kind of traditional notions of masculinity, but also deepen it and push on it and make it fuller and more sustainable. Absolutely. And you bring up Russell Rowland and Shan Ray, great Montana writers. And I think it was when I was in Missoula a couple of days ago, someone asked, you know, do you like being called a Montana writer or a Western writer? Or you just want to be called a writer? And I thought, as long as you call me a writer of some kind, I'm happy with anything. But I do love to be a Montana writer. I have such great company, such great literary friends here in the state. So.
Well, and the way that you've built your characters in this novel, I have no doubt that you'll be able to add many more in your next work and get that stretch that you're looking for.
Great.
Joe, it's been a delight having you here.
Yeah.
Just a reminder for everybody, this book has only been out a couple months. Fall Back Down When I Die, a novel about land, family, wolves, violence, community, and Montana.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. This has been fun.
Thank you, Joe.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.